So it was very socially acceptable at the Buddha's time to be a wandering mendicant, you know, completely socially acceptable because there was such a huge group of them going around. It's interesting because as Buddhism went to different cultures, this, you know, had to change. When Buddhism went to China, being a wandering mendicant was not socially acceptable. You know, in Confucian society, you were really looked down upon. You know, you were seen as a beggar, a flake, you know, or a mooch, whatever it is. And so as a result, you know, when the Sangha, when, you know, when Dharma was spread to China, then they stopped being wandering mendicants in China. It wasn't socially acceptable, and they, you know, were more stationary in different communities. And then people would come and bring food to the communities. That was acceptable. If you were a spiritual practitioner, people respected that when they would come with offerings. But to wander around, that was too much like a beggar. Okay? In Tibet, that also changed. And I think it changed there because it was too cold to wander around. You know, it was freezing. And if you were going to wander around each morning in the village to get your food, you would freeze to death, probably. So, again, they stayed stationary and people would come and make offerings. So, you know, you see that how things were set up at the time of the Buddha was according to the culture and the climate. You know, as the culture and climate changed in different places where the Dharma went, the way of living also changed. This way of living is pretty much, you know, continued in Thailand and Sri Lanka, I think. But, you know, the culture and the climate are very amenable to that. So at the beginning, the Sangha wandered around for to collect alms. And then later, the Buddha made allowances so that if they were invited to somebody's home, then they could receive a meal at somebody's home. And so very often what would happen is early in the morning, somebody would go to where the Buddha was or where some monks were or some nuns and invite them, please come to my home. Or sometimes they would make the invitation the day before. And then, you know, whoever was invited would come and be served. And sometimes that the whoever invited them was usually wealthy and would either, sometimes they had their servants serve the Sangha, or sometimes really to show their great respect, they would serve the Buddha and the Sangha with their own hands. And then afterwards, as a way of reciprocating, then the Buddha, or whoever was most senior there, would give a Dharma talk. You know, so they received the food and then they gave the Dharma talk. So right away at the very beginning, you had the Buddha set up this dependency between the monastic community and the lay community. Okay, they were dependent upon each other. Yeah, the Sangha depended on the lay community for the four requisites, for food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. And the lay community depended on the Sangha for the teachings. And so they were inextricably woven together. So the Buddha's idea was never that the Sangha goes off and isolates themselves. Okay? I find it very interesting that we Westerners have this idea, and I even saw it with our architect, who is fairly new to Buddhism. You know, everybody comes here and says, well, are you going to have individual huts where everybody goes and meditates? And let's make some huts out here, and one's over here, and one's 100 yards down there, and one's 100 yards over here, because you don't want them to see each other, do you? You know, people have this idea that if you're really practicing, you go out all alone, completely in the caves and the mountains, by yourself. Well, that's not the way the Buddha set it up. Yeah, not at all. And I wonder if we Westerners, how we got that idea. And in thinking about it, it seems to me that we're bringing in a little bit of the Christian idea here, because, you know, many of the Christian orders, they were cloistered. They weren't allowed to interact with the laity. Yeah, and I remember when I lived in Italy, sometimes going to, a nunnery, and I was talking with another nun, I couldn't even see her because, we couldn't see each other even though we were talking. And once I went with Tenzin Palmo in Poland, and we went to a nunnery, and they had this grill there, you know, that you talked, we were on different sides, and it was so hard to see each other because some of the bars went this way and some went this way, and you were trying to look at each other, but your eyes got really weird. And we were very curious about each other's prayer beads and things. We were trying to like slip them through the bars. And, so Christianity was set up very much that way. You know, you go off and you never come out. They never see you again. Okay? And so, you know, maybe because of that, we have that kind of image that you do that, and so we bring that into our Buddhist training. Or maybe we think of Milarepa. Well, Milarepa went to live in a cave and, you know, attained enlightenment there. But then Milarepa sang his 100,000 songs, and he sang them to somebody, you know? He didn't, I don't think he wrote his own songs down. He had disciples. There's all the stories of him having discussions with these arrogant people who knew a lot of Dharma but didn't know how to practice. You know, he was very much in relationship to other people. Or I remember when I was in Tibet, outside of Samye, we went up into the mountains and there were different people doing retreat there. But, you know, they were kind of in a community. There were many of them in different places, and the lay people would come and bring them bags of sampa. And, you know, we went in and we made offerings. And if you go to Sopema, there's some people there meditating, and you go and they're, you know, and make offerings to them. And above Dharamsala, where Geshe Eshe Tokten was, there was, you know, a community of different monks that lived in different huts. They didn't function as a community. They all did their own cooking and did their own thing, you know, at their own times. But they helped each other. They lived in close proximity. People came up and visited them. I went up and visited them and talked to them. So, you know, it's quite interesting, this kind of idea that we have in the West, that, you know, you just have to, like, put yourself in this dark room and like this, and because that's not the way the Buddha set it up. He set it up really where there's just this incredible dependency going on. Yeah. So there's a relationship, but there's also very clear delineations about how the monastics and the sangha relate to each other. Okay. So for example, the monastics, you know, aren't permitted to sing and dance and play music. So that automatically restricts your contact with the laity, because you don't go to parties and you don't go to where there's festivities and you don't, you know, do those kinds of things. So it restricts your contact with the laity. And, you know, all sorts of different things like this, you know. For the nuns, there's, you know, many precepts about how we always have to be together with another woman, you know, or particularly another nun. And so you're never caught in a situation where, you know, you're alone with a man and something, you know, who knows what could happen. You know, so there are guidelines about how you relate to each other. And the sangha isn't allowed to go and, you know, say, give me this, or hint around for this or that, or whatever. And you're not allowed to, you know, there's all sorts of rules about when you go in somebody's house, you know, you have to bid them goodbye when you're leaving. You can't just pick up and leave. And you have to bring your cloth and put it down so that if you spill something or make a mess, it doesn't dirty their furniture. And, you know, there's all these kinds of things. And, you know, like I said, when the Sangha misbehaved, the lay people would kind of complain about it to the Buddha. So that's why I think that if the Buddha were alive now, We would have a lot of trainings about we had to recycle. You know, I'm sure lay people would complain. And I complain when I go to these Buddhist temples and they have so much styrofoam and so many paper plates that they use, you know, big gatherings, and then you just have all this stuff and you throw it away. I'm sure, you know, the lay people would complain, and the Buddha would make a precept that you can't, you know, use styrofoam that's bad for the environment. And you have to use plates and wash them, and you have to be aware of your environment, you know. And I'm sure, you know, the Buddha would make precepts about driving in a car and when you can use a car, and you can't just go jump in a car and to go drive into town because you forgot the eggs or you ran out of sugar, you know, because I'm sure lay people would complain about the Sangha just being very wasteful of petrol and polluting things. Yeah? So, you know, even though the Buddha isn't here, I think if we think about it, you know, the whole purpose of so many of the trainings was to behave in ways that were amenable to the people in the society in which we lived, you know, and that were considerate of the people in the society. Yeah. So the Buddha, you know, he didn't set up the Sangha as somebody that just thumbed their nose at other people and said, you know, flipped him off and said, forget you, you know, but very much, you know, you're doing your spiritual practice, but your behavior, you have to be considerate of the people that you live with, but not so considerate that you do unwise things, like lie about your attainments or go off and, you know, give your parents an heir by having sex with your ex-wife or, you know, these kinds of things, okay? So it's kind of an interesting thing. Who's very much, you know, go along with the social norms, but don't give in to peer pressure when somebody wants you to do something that isn't very wise and isn't good for your practice. Okay? So if you study, you know, the precepts as a whole and pull out, you know, why did the Buddha make this particular precept, then it really gives you a lot to think about the kind of mental set that the Buddha wanted us to have. Okay, so in some Buddhist traditions, you'll see that, you know, they follow the precepts extremely literally, whether or not that precept fits in with modern culture. And so those traditions choose to do it that way. That's their practice. The people who are attracted to that tradition, the lay people support them in doing it, and it's okay. Then there's other Buddhist traditions that say, well, we'd much rather look at, like, why the Buddha set up a particular thing, and if we have to change the literalness of the precept in order to go along with the purpose, we're happy to do that. So that way of dealing with the precepts works for that group of people. Okay? So there's different ways nowadays that people will keep the precepts, and each group has, you know, its own good reasons. Now, because some people say, let's do it literally because then everything's just very clean, clear. And even if it doesn't fit in with the culture, it doesn't matter. This is the way we do it. Okay? And then other groups say, no, let's be a little bit more, you know, try and fit in with the culture a little bit more and not make things so inconvenient for the lay people. Okay? So, you know, they both have good reasons for doing what they're doing, and they both attract disciples with different kinds of mentalities or different kinds of dispositions. And so you see that, you know, that's why different traditions act and, you know, do things in different ways. And they all have a good reason for it. Okay, anyway, at the time of the Buddha, you know, so you had all these wanderers, they were accepted by society, they were accepted by the government, okay? And so you often read about the kings giving offerings and donations to the Sangha community. And it was because the view of the government at that time was that you had, the ruler was responsible for the well-being of all the different groups in the society. And so as a way of taking care of all these different groups, then the king or certain wealthy people would give offerings to them. So a king might support the Buddhist Sangha, but they might also support the Jains and support this other wandering sect and support the Brahmins, okay? Because in society, you respected all of these different religious groups, and as a ruler, you were supposed to help sustain all of them. You know, of course, you might divvy it up in different proportions according to your own individual inclinations, but, all of these groups were supported. So from the very beginning, you had some wealthy benefactors coming in and making offerings to the Sangha as a community. Okay, but well, then the question comes: well, they were all these just individual wanderers going around. If you're going to have a community to make offerings to, how do they become a community? Okay, so how they became a community was this. During the monsoon rains in India, if you've ever been in India in the monsoons, it's a real trip. It rains and rains, and everything grows all over the place. And so if they were still going on their alms round, walking all these places, they were walking through the farmers' fields and destroying the fields. There's all these bugs that come out in the monsoons. So they're stepping on the bugs. So then the lay people said, well, wait a minute, they're trampling the crops, they're stepping on the bugs. I thought these are people who are trying not to harm others. What's going on? And so the Buddha said, okay, well, for the 3 months of the rains retreat, then the Sangha should stay stationary. Okay, so you should just stay in one place. And so here you have the development of the avaras. I hope I'm saying this correctly. Avaras and avarya. No, avasa and arama. Sorry, avasa and arama. So the avasas were areas where the monks kind of staked out. You know, there was a group of them and they said, okay, let's stay here during the Vasa, the rains retreat. So they would stake out a certain area and they would build little huts, you know, themselves and very simple kinds of things. So that those were the avasas. Then you have the aramas, and they were places where a wealthy benefactor or even a middle class benefactor would make an offering to the Sangha and say, please come here to my place. And that person would construct buildings and then the Sangha would come and live there while, during the Vasa. And they would be provided for in large part by the benefactors who offered the place for them to live. Okay, so you had the ones that where they were invited and then the ones that they built themselves. So you began, when the Buddha said that there will now be a 3-month retreat where you stay put, then they began to come together in, little communities of monks or nuns in different places. And so when we say, like in the ancient Shravasti, the Buddha spent 25 rainy seasons there, that was, a place where, Anattapindika had offered this park, or Visakha had offered her garden, and then the Sangha would come and live there. They wouldn't wander, but the townspeople or the big benefactor would come and bring food every day, and then they would do their practice in that particular place. But then, the Buddha also set up a precept whereby at the end of the rainy seasons, then you had to leave. Okay, so you had to leave, and for the other 9 months, you were supposed to go back to wandering and going different places as you're wandering around. But gradually, it kind of changed because especially in the places, let's say where the benefactor built a nice place for the Sangha to stay, well, then they would come back to do their rains retreat there the next year. And so you needed to have somebody maintain the buildings from 1 year to the next. Okay? Or they just kind of came back, even if the benefactor maintained the buildings. The Sangha, the same group, would kind of come back year after year. Or even some people might switch around to different locations. A lot of them came back, and just some were newcomers. Or even at the avasas, where the monks built the things themselves, then, you know, a steady group would maybe come back to the same area every year because they liked it. Okay, so you began to have, okay, 3 months out of the year were kind of settled. Yeah, and then, you know, we just kept coming back to the same place every year, year after year, so you're kind of even more settled. And then after a while, it was like, well, why leave? You know, we need to, it's comfortable here, and we're supported, and we need to take care of the buildings. And also what happened is that the people who would come back year after year, they would get preference in the housing, and then the new ones would like fit in later. Yeah. And so from there, you know, if you just kept coming back to the same place year after year and you were giving the preference in the housing, and then it's just very easy. You just stay on after that. Yeah. And so then there became, you know, these settled communities. And at first, you know, they were settled, and all the Sangha members had, you know, they would maybe still all get up in the morning and go out for alms and come back to the same place and share their food and eat together. They would kind of have Dharma discussions, but they were still maybe living in their own huts, and there wasn't a strict daily schedule that they all followed, and, you know, and things like that. So they were still a very, very loose group. Yeah. As time went on, then again that changed, okay? Because especially as people made more donations, then you had to have some kind of institutional structure to support this. You needed somebody who managed the food, and somebody who managed the housing, and somebody who took care of repairs. And so then they had these diverse communities began to, you know, began to function more closely together instead of just being a group that lived near each other and did a similar practice. They began to have to organize each other so that everybody had different responsibilities. Okay? And so from there, you know, you got to this third step where monasteries began to form. Okay? So you had first just the wanderers, and then they began to be kind of settled, first being settled just for the 3 months, then going back to the same place year after year for those 3 months, then staying all year round but not really functioning together, you know, having a lot of organization. Okay? And then from there to the third step of beginning to have more organization. Okay? And I think what probably went along with this is the development of the Vinaya and the development of the Pratimoksha vows. Because at the beginning, the precepts, the trainings that we had, were very much individual trainings. You know, you have these various trainings that you do, and you follow them, and they were designed to help your own individual spiritual practice. Yeah. But then you can see there's all these things about, you know, different levels of precepts and trainings, and if you don't follow them, what happens? And I'll talk about this more tomorrow. But what happens? And so what happens is dealt with by the community. Yeah. So to have a community use disciplinary forces against or powers against other people who didn't follow the ways of living together, the guidelines of that community, you needed a certain level of organization. There needed to be a certain central authority. Okay, so while the Buddha was alive, he was the authority, Yeah, so he was the one who established the various precepts. But then, you know, at the beginning, they were just precepts that were recited. But then, you know, when you look at the Pratimoksha, there's all these different categories, and some of them you have to confess against, you know, in front of the community, and some of them, if you misbehave, you receive admonishment 3 times before the community, and some of them, if you misbehave, you're suspended. And so you need to have a certain level of organization to have this kind of enforcement. Yeah. So what I find interesting is when we look at the Pratimoksha vows, they're kind of presented to us as, okay, well, here's this code and this is what we live by. But when you think about it historically, there must have been an evolution that went on. Because surely at the beginning it couldn't have been like that. Okay?